Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use.
Hello and welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This is our weekend edition where we look at a few more news stories that we didn't get to on Friday, and then we will have a middle section where Victor talks about a historical and, well, in this case, literary topic, and it will be Roman historians. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to the Weekend Edition. Victor is the Martin and Neely Anderson Senior Fellow in Military History and Classics at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. You can find him at his website, victorhanson.com. The name of the website is Blade of Perseus. Please come join us for a free subscription, lots of free things on the website, or a $5 a month or $50 a year subscription where you can read the VDH Ultra articles. So, Victor, we've got still some more news that I wanted, we wanted to talk about, and I'm looking for the first one, which is RFK Jr. has a vice presidential candidate, Nicole Shanahan, and I was wondering your ideas about this pick as a vice presidential candidate.
Well, she's was married, I think, to Sergey Brin. Is that right?
I'll trust you on that. I didn't check on that.
Yeah, I think, and she's through marriage, she's one of the wealthiest women in the United States, sort of analogous, although not quite the same magnitude as Jeff Bezos' wife. I was kind of surprised because he's packaging himself as on the fence between left-wing and right-wing populism. And so he attracts a lot of people about he's for closed borders. He's skeptical about overreach of government during quarantine, skeptical about the mRNA vaccination. And so the conventional wisdom was he was going to attract equally Trump and Biden voters. But with this vice presidential selection, I think he thinks that she's got a lot of money, or she has entree to a lot of money that can help him in fundraising, that he's kind of tilted a little bit more to the left. And that explains why today the Democratic pros and handlers are very angry about it, because they feel now he's shown his true self, some people on the right who have donated to Trump are donating to him, and they feel that he's a stalking horse for Trump. I don't think he is, but when you look at all of the potential third candidates, whether it's Dennis Kucinich or Jill Stein or Cornel West or Robert Kennedy, they're going to take more from Biden than they are Trump. And in some of these king states where the Electoral College tally will be decided by anywhere from 30 to 100,000 votes, it could make a big difference. So, bottom line, expect them to demonize, get the whole Kennedy clan out like they have before to disown him, say he's horrible, he's a renegade, he's awful, and they will try to destroy him.
Yeah.
The way they do everyone that they find is a threat to their hold on power.
Yeah, you know, I noticed in the New York Post today that they also had a story about how Nicole Shanahan had helped to route millions to pro-migrant, anti-cop groups. And so I think she's not going to resonate well with very many people on the right. So do you think that this will take more away from Joe Biden's voters?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that was the purpose of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do. I think he's trying to tell people that he gets a lot more press, he gets a lot more anger, he gets a lot more out of it when they're angry. And where if and he can't say when this blows up and it's going to blow up that he was pro-Trump. He's going to say, well, look, you guys weren't pure enough for me. I was the true progressive populist, not you. Whereas if he had drifted into Trump land, I think they would have said, you sold out and worked for Trump.
Yeah, but...
And they wouldn't have made the distinction, Sammy. They said, well, you sold out for Trump, but at least you took more votes away from Trump than you did from Biden, therefore we like you. They don't think that way.
Oh, okay. That's what I was like.
They're just emotional.
Because his candidacy will definitely drive Biden's win to even lower and lower possibility, with Trump's win being a greater possibility. So wouldn't he want to be... I mean, maybe he wants Trump to win or something. I don't know. It's very strange.
It's just... If Donald Trump can control himself, and it's hard to do when you're being smeared and slandered in these court proceedings, and not attack the daughter of the judge who's looking at the Alvin Bragg case, which he did, but which she's a political on the left, so her dad is a political on the left, it's blatantly political, but somehow he's going to have to moderate his speech. He could get sympathy, he could get out of these things, and he could be the beneficiary of all these third-party candidates.
Yeah.
And he may even be able to be financially okay when it's okay over. And he could take the Senate, enlarge his House margin, and get the White House back.
Yeah.
And if that were to happen, it would be a historic development, given where he was after January 6th of 2021.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at a poll by Politico and Ipsos, and they were generally, the way they asked questions sort of required the response to be mostly pro what the left would like. So most of the questions I did not like, but they did ask one. One third of independents said they would not vote Trump if convicted in trials. And I thought that sounds like the Democrats are succeeding in what they're doing, because that's all that matters is these independents.
One third is all?
Yeah, but that...
That means two-thirds of independents would not mind if he had pinstripes and he was talking through jail bars?
Yes, you just excited
that
the dogs.
That's a pretty amazing statistic, so...
You think that's good on the side of Trump, I guess.
Yeah, I do. I really do, because... if he can win, all he has to do is run even with independents, because the Democratic registration in most states is now almost where the Republican is. And if it's true that he's picking up 20% of the black vote, 45% of the Latino vote, I don't believe he's ahead, as some people suggest, he will win. He will win. And if he monitors the mail-in balloting, that's a big if.
Mm.
But things are going in his way. All he has to do is be very careful about what he says.
Yeah. Well, apparently he's not too worried about the women's vote, which he, I don't know, he's got a long way to go with that if he even tries. Well, then let's look at Zuckerberg is going to limit access to political content on Instagram. So he's just out and out saying what he's going to censor this time around and probably put a lot more money into getting important people elected in specific districts that need to be won. But I was wondering your thoughts on all of this.
I don't quite understand him. He's one of the most disliked people in the United States because he's arrogant. He's building his whatever $80 million bomb-proof shelter in Hawaii and building a wall around what was once accessible pathways to the beach. He gave $419 million to absorb the work of registrar in the 2020. You'd think he would just say, you know what? I probably did more than anybody. See Molly Ball's article in Time of 2021, Time Magazine in February. And it was controversial. And I have no business trying to create a quasi-government shadow bureaucracy to enhance mail-in balloting with my $419 million. So I'm just going to keep out of it.
Yeah.
We can't do that. I'm not going to censor it. I'm not going to work with the FBI. I'm not going to go in there and try to modulate news content like I did with Twitter in 2020. These people can't quit. They don't understand. And I have a feeling he's one of the most unpopular people in the United States. I really do. And I don't know why he wouldn't just keep out of it. Every time he testifies before Congress, he looks like some kind of weird, arrogant nerd that's on the spectrum. You know what I mean? It's just, he's not in touch with his emotions or his analysis. And remember he turned around and said, I apologize to people in the chamber.
Yeah.
And then he's got these, he went to Meta and it's alternate reality and all of this stuff that he's into. And I don't know. I would doubt within 10 years, even though he buys up companies like crazy, he's like Google. He buys 200 or 300 companies up a year to eliminate the competition, that he's not a major player. Because I don't think Facebook is going to continue the way it used to be.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the new generation doesn't even really know Facebook. It's all TikTok. And yeah.
Well, he buys these up as they appear on the market. I mean, he tries to cash them out and take hold. He's like an octopus. Yeah. It's like what Frank Norris wrote about in The Octopus, a conglomerate.
Yeah. Well, another topic in the news is the U.S. nuclear ability. And in the case of Powerline, which I got the story from, they call a U.S. nuclear deficit, that France has over 50 nuclear plants that it uses, and it's got plenty of electricity, of course. But the U.S. in the same time period built almost none. And I thought that that was an interesting contrast. What happened there? Why is the France so into it and we are so far away?
Well, I mean, we had Three Mile Island, and Chernobyl's a long way from France, I suppose, and they realized that they don't want to burn coal. That was always, they had a lot of coal. And so when they went nuclear, they were right next to Germany as well. And so they realized that they could sell really high-priced electricity to Germany, the Germans were completely unhinged on power. They shut down not just their coal plants, which they're reopening, by the way, and their oil fed, which they're reopening, but their natural gas plants. And they went solar and wind. And anybody's been to Germany in the summer, it's very cold. And there's no sun. It's not always that windy. It's just, so it was crazy what they did. They self-destructed. It was collective suicide. And France is selling them electricity. Mm. They're going to continue to do it. And I suppose when we get to these mini fusion plants they're talking about that are, you know, this provide electricity, say, for communities of 5,000, and they're the size of, I don't know, a barn or something, and they don't pollute in the sense of radioactive material, that we'll be behind on that too.
Apparently they are, you know, I confess I was listening to that crazy Joe Rogan for a while. They were talking about they're going to get nuclear generation so small that they can generate clocks and things, like they'll have their own independent nuclear generation.
I think that's true. I don't think the United States is at the cutting edge of any of this stuff as far as policy. Because the DEI, when I mean DEI, I don't mean just race. I'm talking about DEI, ESG, all of these impediments that are ideologically based, that are not founded on market reality or pure logic. So if you have your major companies and they are guiding their investments on basis of environmental or diversity or social equity and not market realities, or you're hiring and promoting on race or sexual orientation or gender, then you're in a very competitive world, you're not going to be competitive. And when you have all, when you let 10 million people in from the poorest areas of the world in just 3 years, you're not going to be able to take hundreds of millions of dollars and invested in research and development. And when you take your universities and you have your faculty going to workshops, I had to go to, I think it was 3 hours, to do this crazy harassment this and diversity that. And you have all these people that are non-productive, and yet they run the admissions and the promotions with veto power, then you're going to lose your edge. And it's already happening. And it's happening, we talked about that last time, whether it's United Pilots or Boeing planes or Anheuser-Beer or the Pentagon getting troops. DEI is just, it's insidious. It's everywhere. But we just have this nice euphemism, DEI. We've known it before. It was aristocratic prejudice or restriction of participation to only the wealthy, or the Middle East idea, you only hire your first cousin, or the Maoist idea that you have a cultural revolution to destroy people based on their perceived counter-revolutionary ideas. But whatever it is, Jacobism, Stalinism, it harms and wars with productivity and modernism and advance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very sad as an American to say that Airbus is pulling ahead of Boeing, and that, I don't know, Air France, we used to, when I was a student, we called that Air Chance.
Really?
Yeah. And it's pulling ahead of United and American Airlines. And it's just, it's, and these are socialist stagnant countries that are ossified. But my God, I don't know what we're doing. We're just
going like backward.
We're going backwards. This bridge will never be rebuilt, this Francis Scott Key, as it was, and it will probably not be built for years.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if we have the technology to do it. I'm just speaking as they've still shut down five parallel roads in my vicinity because of a high-speed rail project. 10 years, not a foot of rail laid. And now 41, the main avenue from the Central Valley to the coast, they're going to shut down 17 miles to widen it. We never did that in our entire life when we were young. These people look like giants compared to us. It's really this snotty, snarky, self-satisfied, pampered baby boomer generation that's ruined all these institutions they inherited, the media, the universities. Gosh, I always thought John Chancellor and Walter Cronkite and, you know, were people like that were prejudiced and biased and too left-wing, but they look like saints today compared to this, you know.
Group. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I just remembered you wanted to say something more from the Friday episode on Ronna McDaniel and the NBC being hired and fired within a day.
Yeah, they fired her within a day, and what I didn't understand about it, we talked about how it was asymmetrical that, you know, Fox hires Jessica Tarkoff or Juan Williams and others, and they can't handle that. But what I was curious about is when they're doing that, they obviously do not want. Why don't they want her there? Do you really believe it's because they think she lied?
No.
No. It's because when they have a discussion and Joy Reid is going, you know, on and on and on and says, don't you think that Fannie Willis or Alvin Bragg have the goods? What do you think, Rona? They're afraid. She said, no, here's why.
Yeah.
And they can't handle that. They cannot handle any dissent whatsoever. It's like Pravda. They cannot have any dissenting voice. And so when you think about it, where do you get your information? The only place you get your information that's not part of the Borg is on internet sites, podcasts, Fox News. Where else do you get it? Is there any newspaper except for the Epoch Times that you can get an honest appraisal? No. And is there any public vehicle? PBS, NPR? No. Is there a network news? No. Is there cable, Fox, maybe Newsmax? That's it. And so they don't want any dissenting voice. They still believe that they got away with Russian collusion and laptop disinformation and the ping-ping story and the sucker story and the PP tape. For them and the lab, it was, you know, it was a pangolin bat or something. They got away with all of that.
Yeah.
They don't ever want anybody to question it.
Yeah. Well, one more thing just before we go. Did you notice that Jon Stewart was being criticized since he said, oh, look at Trump. He undervalued for tax purposes and overvalued for asset purposes. And his own house was undervalued at $1.8 million for tax purposes.
And then he sold it.
17.2, of course.
Yeah, John, we'll do the ratio and see if you were any worse than what Trump did. The fact of the matter is that the state is years behind in assessing property values. At least they were until they were broke. Now they're getting on it really quickly, but nobody knows what the volatile stock market value is on any given month. And that was Trump's point. He said, well, if it was $17 million, and that's what I pay taxes on, they'd have no idea what year that applied to or anything. They have no idea what's going on in Palm Beach. And the market is what you can get for it.
Yeah.
So, and the thing is, he sold that for what, $17, $18 million?
Yes, his little house. It was
and the guy
duplex.
Who bought it then tried to sell it and lost $4 or $5 million.
Is that right?
Yeah, 6 or 7 years later. So the point was that, and nobody's going to prosecute him for deliberately
overvaluing.
Understating his, for tax purposes and overstating, I guess, for market realities.
Yeah.
All these people do that, and everybody knows that. This whole thing is just so absurd about the Letita James case. You know, I farmed for a number of years. I bought homes. And when you think of it, you know, I've gone to the Federal Land Bank to get loans on, and they would say, Victor, what do you think that Thompson Vineyard's worth? There's a guy, I won't mention his name, I kind of admired him. He was like a cranky, you're not going to make a man. If you want to keep farming, if I were you, I'd rent it out. Just rent it out. You can do a lot of things, but one thing you can't do is farm. And everybody I know who's going to survive the big crash of the 80s will be the guy who doesn't farm. If you want to lose your place, farm it. That was his attitude. And he was kind of right. I wrote about him in Fields Thought Dreams, but I'd go in there, I'd say, well, I think for our loan, I think the vineyard's worth $5,000. You couldn't get $3,500 for it. I said, but look in the paper. They're selling Thompson Vineyard for $5,500. Yeah, and who's buying it? Tell me who's buying it. They'll be up there for a month. No, I'm going to give you $3,500. That's the only value. And I said, okay. But the point is, if I went in there and said there was $5,500, as Trump went on there and said Mar-a-Lago's worth $500 million, it didn't matter. It's the guy with the money who tells you what the value of your property is. And he had auditors. And he pulled out a bunch of papers and he said, here's the average price of Thompson Vineyard sold in Fresno County the last 2 months. They know everything. So it was just absurd what they did.
Yes.
Everybody knows that, too. And that was what's so funny. And, you know, there's so many things about this case you cannot talk about either. I mean, when you had deliberately these juries were in blue jurisdictions, and then there was almost a racist component to the way that Letitia James and Fannie Willis and Alvin Bragg campaign for office. You know, we're going to get Donald Trump and we're going to get him. And it became kind of a black thing. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to talk about it. But it was like the patois, the dialect, the whole idea was we've got street cred. We're going to get this big old white guy and we're going to really humiliate him. And nobody could talk about that except Trump. Remember, Trump kept saying it was racist. They were picking him out. But my point is this. Does Fannie Willis think right now? And does Alvin Bragg think right now? And does Letitia James think right now that if there was a major candidate running for office like Barack Obama and he was a black man and there was a white redneck prosecutor in Georgia and he said something like, well, he got a deal with Tony Resco. Tony, he wanted to expand his backyard. And Tony Resco got a favorable vote from him in the legislature. And he paid half of market value. And he didn't list that as a gift. That's tax fraud. And we're going to go after him. If he was just a minor prosecutor from another state and kind of turned it into a federal, you know, bootstrapped it into some type of federal RICO charge or something, because that's what she's doing.
Yeah.
Or saying, you know, he has a bank account in my jurisdiction, something like that. They would go nuts. They would say he's a racist. He's a white prosecutor going after a proud black man. That's what they would do. And so there's something going on, you know, when you have all of these prosecutors, Bragg and Letitia James and Fannie Willis. And it's not me who's talking about race. It's they are. Just take her trial, for example. You know, she said they asked her about Nick. I'm not going to talk about a proud black man. I'm not going to talk about him. Remember when they were trying to say about him? And then she said, you don't understand about cash. It's a black thing. Black people keep.
That was her father, I think, said.
No,
that.
She said it too.
Did she say it too?
Her father came and then he reiterated. I thought, well, wait a minute. I know a lot of black people. I've never heard them say that their attitude toward cash was any different than anybody else. But again, it was that retreat to race. And the same thing with Fannie Willis when she was campaigning. And the same thing with Eric Adams. That, remember, he campaigned, and when he was being criticized because of his pathetic administration, he turned and he said to the cameras, this is a chocolate city. Look at them. You see any white people? Remember he said that? He pointed all, this is a chocolate city. And he ran on, you know, I was the guy that went after the crackers. And what I'm getting at is that no one wants to talk about this.
Yeah.
But we need to get back to content of your character. But there's a racial element of just furor here. And there's left-wing bias. We saw that with Ingeron. And we'll see it with Jack Smith. But there's also a sense that this inner city culture resents Donald Trump, and especially it's being guided by the bi-coastal left-wing elite, and they're going to go after him in a way that is gloating. We've never seen anybody like Letitia James. We've never really seen this before where these prosecutors like Fannie Willis go into a church, a black church, and then announce that she's a victim of racism because she's lied under oath or she's in a very dishonest fashion that is, it's just not appropriate to hire her paramour and then to pay him this money and then to claim that she didn't really get anything free from him because she paid him back in cash, but whoops, she didn't have any money. And then to go into church and say, anybody who questions my word is a racist. That's what she did.
Yeah.
So they bring up race all the time. And then you think, well, is this a motivating factor?
Yeah.
And
it's not good for civilization. Not when you've got multi-ethnic.
It's not when you have three black prosecutors who are, and most of all the prosecutors now in the major cities and the mayors are black, which is fine. That's a democratic, but we don't go by proportional representation. we always say, you know, the official has to look like America. We always say that, we thought. And then repertory omissions or whatever appointments or profiles came into favor. So all of a sudden, you know, there's not enough black coaches. They have to match the demography. But if the NBA or the NFL is overwhelmingly black, it's okay because of the historic discrimination against blacks. It means they're exempt as a group. And same thing with, if you look at the mayors of, say, the largest 20 towns, you know, or I should say cities in America, they tend to be mostly black. I understand their populations are minority majorities, but still. And the same thing with prosecutors. And this was George Soros who deliberately found radical prosecutors to run and then to fund them with 1 and 2 million. We had the same thing with the DA in Chicago that let Jesse Smollett off, and he was communicating with people she was that were, you know, connected with Juicy Smollett and Michelle Obama, of all things. So this is something that we don't talk about, but everybody is, I think, upset about, that these prosecutors are very racialized. They're not because of the color of their skin, but because culturally they feel that they are, that there's a racial edge to their prosecution. Again, that's not me saying it. It's Fannie Willis playing the race card again and again and again. It's Eric Adams as the mayor bringing race to the fore anytime he's criticized and bragging that there is no white people on his council. Or it's Letitia James campaigning in a way that to black audiences that she's going to get this guy, and then she's going to gloat about how she's done it. And it's not healthy.
No, not at all. Well, Victor, let's take a break and then come back and look at our Roman historians. Stay with us and we'll be back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back. So, Victor, the Roman historians, Livy, Tacitus, Polybius, and, Plutarch, actually Plutarch and Polybius were both Greek, I believe. So
that's a good point, because when you talk about Roman history, you assume that people wrote in Latin, but really the first extant historian we have is Livy, and he was writing in the period of about 10 BC to 10 or 15 AD, and so what I'm getting at is most of them wrote in Greek. They were Greeks who were Romanized. And the most famous, of course, was Polybius. He was born around 200, lived probably, he was somebody who lived probably 80, 70s, late, you know, he lived all the way up to well past the end of the first, the Third Punic War. But he was the most gifted of all of them. He was from a town called Megalopolis, the big city. You can go there today. It's a Hellenistic city in the Peloponnese, and you can still see the theater. And he was born there. There's a monument to him. But he's famous because he's the only historian, along with Tacitus, who is considered Thucydidean. That is, he approaches history as if he's a physician. These are the symptoms. I'm going to make a diagnosis. This would be the therapy if they were to be corrected, but this is the prognosis if they continue on as they are. And his main theme, he wrote a history of basically from the beginning around 265, 264, roughly contemporaneous with the First Punic War, the War of Athens, that's Carthage against Rome, down to the end of the Third Punic War in 146. And he wants to prove or show why it was that this little Italian peninsula, where Rome was just one of many city-states, in a very rapid fashion unified the Italian peninsula and then grew beyond its borders to encompass most of southern Europe and then destroyed the Carthaginian Empire over a century of three wars and got control of the entire western Mediterranean and then turned its attention to the Macedonians, Epirotes that were controlling Greece and the Near East, and then were able to expand the Roman Empire all the way into the Hellenist, what had been Hellenistic Alexander the Great's territory and the successors. And by the time of Augustus, or I should say, he didn't know that, of course. He finished writing somewhere around 130s, 120s, and his history stops in 146. But he presaged or he predicted that it would take over the entire world, and he was right. And so why was that? And he comes to the point I think it's book six, he has an editorialization. Why did this happen? Why did they beat the Macedonians? Why did they beat the Carthaginians? Why? And the answer is they had a mixed constitution, and he defines that in two manners. And when they were, and one is that they had politically an executive branch, two consuls, not one, two, that could check each other's power and were annually elected. Then they had a legislative body to check the councils, and they had a, and that was, of course, the powerful Senate. But they also had tribal assemblies that, and they had as well a judicial branch. And they were various censors and auditors that enforced the laws from a judicial point of view. And he said that meant that power was not hoarded or conglomerated in too few hands. There were no dictators. Or if there was a dictator, as in the Second Punic War for a while, they were carefully guarded and controlled by the Senate, their terms. And as long as you had that balance of power, then there was no political revolutions or upheavals or constant periods of destruction, self-destruction, as there were when it broke down after his death in the late Republic and as it did in the Imperial. And the other definition of a mixed society, within that political framework that checked power, there was a concordance of the orders. So there were the wealthy aristocratic class, and they controlled the Senate, and then there was the tribunal assemblies and the tribuneship, and they were from the lower classes, and they had veto power in many cases over senatorial decrees, and many of them called a novus homo, a new man. Cicero was a new man who could come out of the provinces, become by his merit and a successful orator, barrister, lawyer, and end up as a senator. And then there were the poor people that there were certain people had to defer to the people who controlled the inner cities, for example. Later it would be called bread and circuses. But what I'm getting at is this constitutional system divided the rule of power between legislators, executives, and judges. And it did, in the same fashion, it was able to incorporate the poor, the middle, and the wealthy. And so he concludes that it's a more stable system than anyone else, and that allowed it to unite the people.
Grow and prosper.
And grow and prosper. And that's mm-hmm. really the theme of his history that centers on the three Punic Wars. Most of the Third Punic War is lost. For that, we have to find things in Livy and Plutarch. The next historian, though, that's remarkable is Livy, and he's really the first extant, extant in the sense that his history is complete in large fashion. It's not complete. There's a lot of books. He wrote 142 books, and it's called Ab Urbe Condita, from the founding of Rome in the 8th century all the way to his period. And he draws on a lot of lost historians, obviously. But he's a guy who was born around 59, 60 BC. And as I said, he died around 17. So he's writing somewhere in his prime around the time of Christ. And he's going back through earlier sources and trying to talk about what Rome was like in the 750s BC. So all these famous stories that we have, Cincinnatus at the bridge, and
The Rape of Lucretia.
They all come from Livy, Book 1 to 5. The mythologies, the, Remus and the wolf being nurtured by the wolf. All of those foundational myths are found in Livy, even though he wrote at a very late period. And he's not a Polybius or a Tacitus. He's more Herodotean. In other words, he says, they say, this is what I heard. These are alternate accounts rather than, does this account make sense? Does this account, is it widely accepted? Does this account adequately explain something in the way that Thucydides does? Remember, all of these historians use speeches, and they don't mean they reheard a Scipio speak themselves, or they heard Caesar speak themselves, but they followed the Thucydidean model that I put words into the mouth of characters to reflect what should have been said if it wasn't said. In other words, I tried to have people in my history speak the things that I wrote down or I heard was written down or I know was happened. But however, in some cases when that was impossible, I put words into their mouth that would be likely to have been said, in my opinion. So that makes it very loose. But all of these historians have speeches, and Livy's speeches tend to be a little bit more fabricated or mythical or less factual, but he's one of the only sources that we have for the Third Punic War. But most of his work, as I said, it's huge, and it's lost. He writes in I would call it the Asiatic style. It's a Latin that's very verbose. It has a lot of poetic words in it. It's easy to read as compared to Tacitus, and it's very, very popular with later writers. For example, a lot of the Roman material that Plutarch will use comes from Livy, and he's very popular in the Renaissance. And he was the author of antiquity to go in the Renaissance. We have a very different author, and that is Plutarch. He wrote around 100 AD, and he was a Greek who lived in Chaeronea, about 100 miles from where Polybius was born. Chaeronea is a little tiny town. It's modern Heronia in Greece. It's about, 15, 20 miles from Thebes. Not too far, maybe 10 miles from Lavadia. You go near it as you go up to Delphi.
Sorry. Can you do that again, Victor? It's about a lot Lavadia. Sorry, Robert, cut that out.
Robert. So Chaeronea is about, it's 10 or 15 miles, maybe 20 from Thebes, and it's maybe 5 or 6, 10 from the other big city in Boeotia, which is Lavadia. And what's interesting about Plutarch, remember, he's a Roman citizen that wrote in Greek. It's a Greek that's very polished and erudite, but it's not classical Greek in the sense that it's being written about 450 years after Thucydides and the playwrights, etc. And he's not born until 46, I think, and he lives a long life, 120 AD, but most of the lives that he writes about are around 100. And what did he write about? We have almost more Plutarch than any other author in Greek He's written a huge work called The Moralia, Things on Moral. And it's letters about marriage and comportment and behavior and ethnic vignettes, the saying of Spartan women. And it was very popular in the Renaissance as kind of table talk. But he's most famous for what we would call the parallel lives. And it was his vision that he wanted to show his Roman citizenry. After all, they were running Greece. And in his time, the city-states, he has some very moving passages in some of the lives that the Greek countryside's been deserted. It's not vibrant. There's not the old city-state that there used to be 400 or 500 years ago. It's latifundia, big corporate agriculture that's monocropped, etc. But in any case, he wrote something called The Parallel Lives, and it takes one Greek life and compares it with one Roman life. And so, and they do it by profession. So for Caesar, there's Alexander. For Cicero, there's Demosthenes. And we have, I think we have about 23 of these that are extant. That is, we have both of the surviving lives. And then he had a little short comparison to show you the strengths and weaknesses of each one. And it's fascinating. And much of what we know about the great men of antiquity come from Plutarch. And they're based on, of course, sources that he had at his disposal that we don't in many cases, because he's writing 300-400 years after the fact. Remember, he's writing during the imperial period when there is no such thing as politics. He's one of these very lucky people who comes of age during the Flavian, Titus, Vespasian, and then he's going to be alive at the very dawn of the so-called 100 years of good emperorship, the period of Antonius Pius, Hadrian, Trajan, and Marcus Aurelius, and Nerva, of course. Plutarch is a moralist, so a lot of what we find in stories in Shakespeare, for example, there's translations often from the French, from Greek to French to English, but a lot of Shakespeare had access to the texts of Plutarch, probably in English from French, from Greek. And so a lot of his Shakespearean plays that concern antiquity, like Caesar or Livius Andronicus and things like that, will come from stories that are in the Parallel Lives and Moralia. I think we have time this time around for one last historian of the four that are very famous in the Roman period, and that's Tacitus. He's very different than the other three. He was a contemporary of Livy, maybe born a little bit earlier, 56. And he's like Livy, he had a long life into his 70s, I think, or maybe late 60s, middle 60s, probably died around 120. And he's famous for a history which we call the annals and then the histories. And that is it's a period that talks about Augustus and then the reign of Tiberius, Claudius. And then we get into Caligula, and then we get into the nightmare of Nero, and then the Otho Galba, the four Vitellus, the four emperors in 1 year. And then we get into the end with Vespasian. And the earlier period are called the annals, and the other are the histories. But in addition to that, he wrote some monographs. And I haven't really read in Latin the dialogue on oratory. I've never read that. I read the histories and the annals. But two things that I read very carefully were the life of Agricola. And that was a relative by marriage of his who was a provincial governor. And he talks about, it's a very good synopsis of what a Roman statesman, what he must be like when he's abroad. He's a general, and he's actually, I think he's Tacitus's father-in-law. But it goes through Agricola was stationed in Britain, and it really is a kind of an ethno-history of what the Romans were trying to do in Britain. The more famous one, I think one person called it the most dangerous book in antiquity. I reviewed a book, it was an English book with that title, is the Germania, and that is a ethno-history of the Germans. Remember, the Germans were on the wrong side of the Danube and the Rhine, so they were never absorbed or integrated into the empire. And of course, German historians made a lot of that, Nietzsche, Spengler, Hegel, that they were separate. They were never contaminated by the corruption of Western culture entirely. They got the best of the West, but then they had this sort of blood and soil purity. Hitler played upon it as well. But he describes all the tribes in Germany, and especially those that he knows the most about, which means closer to the Rhine and Danube. And the thing about it is, you would think he'd be very critical given these horrific wars they've had with Romans in his time and earlier, and given the idea they're not civilized in the sense they don't have roads and aqueducts, at least away from the Rhine and Danube. But he has almost a kind of a Rousseauian idea they're noble savages, that they haven't been corrupted by urbanism and decadence and money. And they worship trees, and they bathe in cold water, they drink milk, the women are bare-breasted, they're big and strong. And anyway, that profile of Germany became very popular in a way that suggested that later Goths or Ostgoths or Germanic tribes were romanticized in Rome, that, well, maybe they're taking us over, or maybe they're coming in because they didn't suffer from our civilization. What destroyed us was sloth, leisure, wealth. They were natural people, and they were more hardy, and they deserve it. That kind of naivete was about them. It's kind of what Western societies feel in general, you know, that I heard that, remember when George W. Bush said, I don't know why we don't want closed border. Who's going to rebuild our city after Katrina? As if, you know, and Joe Biden said that the other day, too. He said, who's going to build our homes? As if poor people from Oaxaca, Mexico are the only people who are hardy enough to go up there, and that all Americans are sitting and playing video games in the basement. I've had a lot of Mexican-American, I should say illegal, people who came illegally here and claim that their second generation were not hardworking like that, that they had been Americanized. In other words, they were no longer poor. That's a typical immigrant complaint, but that idea comes from the Germania in large part.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, Victor, let's go to a break and then come back and talk a little bit. It is Easter Sunday tomorrow, and so that's the resurrection. So maybe a few topics on that, a current event, and then we'll talk about the resurrection. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome back, Victor. So there was a news article this week, and I was surprised because it was in Newsweek. It was by Anthony D. Andreassi, and he was talking about the persecution of Christians in the modern world. And his number was 340 million Christians live in countries where they are persecuted. And of course, he talked mostly about Nigeria, where the numbers of Christians versus the numbers of Muslims is more or less even. and the Christians are often subject to crimes and being killed. And I was wondering if you had some thoughts on that state, because it seems to me that Muslims do not have that same problem when they live in Christian countries, that they are subject either to persecution or murder.
Are you suggesting that Muslims who migrate to, say, Dearborn, Michigan, can have mosque and they can worship freely, but a bunch of fundamentalist Christians in Michigan, if they wanted to go over to Saudi Arabia and start a Bible society, or they wanted to proselytize in Gaza, they wouldn't be allowed to?
Yes, or yes. They would have a lot of trouble doing that.
It's called Islamophobia, just so you know.
I'm in a state of, well, if it's the state of truth, I'll accept whatever word you put to it.
It's more or less true. When I first went to Istanbul in 1973, it was under a dictatorship, but a secular one. It was part of the tradition of Ataturk. Remember, he got rid of the fez and he got rid of Arabic script for the Turkish language and started using European sort of letters and things. And there were churches a lot everywhere, Greek Orthodox churches. Not everywhere, but there were Armenian and Greek Orthodox, even Serbian. Each year that I have gone back, I've been maybe 4 or 5 years under Erdogan, it's worse and worse. You see the churches shuttered. And then iconically, Hagia Sophia, the great cathedral built by Justinian in the 530s, when it was taken over and made into a mosque in 1453 by Mehmet II. So it was redone, and there, of course, they had the minarets that were there. I think I related the fact that I gave a lecture once there and said that these minarets were strapped on, or I shouldn't say strapped on, but put on as religious adornments to this beautiful cathedral 50 years after the conquest. And my minder, Turkish minder, interrupted me and said, "Stop, that's not true, and you're not going to be able to continue if you don't speak the truth." I said, "What? Well, the whole cathedral was poorly designed and only the minarets keep it up." I said, "No, it's been there for 1,000 years. So before you came, and it's, you know, so that shows you that there's a lot of religious intolerance now in Turkey. And Santa Sophia, Hagia Sophia is what now? It's a mosque again. It was yanked out of its UN protected site status as a museum, a religious site open to everybody, and now it's been Islamicized. So you go in there, and all the work on the restorations of the Greek frescoes and the idea that you're going to restore it the way it was built, it stopped.
Yeah.
And the same is true if you go anywhere in Ionia, Asia Minor, which was Greek for 3,000 years after the destruction of Constantinople as a Greek city. Of course, organized Greek Orthodox was destroyed until the 19th century, but then the big idea, the megal idea, tried to restore it, but it's gone now. And I was talking to a Turkish journalist about 3 or 4 years ago in Rhodes, and he was explaining to me as he pointed, we were in Halicarnassus, Turkish Bodrum, the ancient city, Greek city of Halicarnassus, and he pointed out at the Greek Dodecanese Islands. There were 3 of them, I think, we could see. He said, "These are all Turkish. They'll be Turkish. They're in our airspace. They're Turkish." I said, no, they're Greek. This place we're sitting on was Greek. You took this from the Greeks." But I think that's true, that it's just something that everybody's afraid of. You can make a cartoon, Charlie Hebdo or whatever it was called. You can make a cartoon and make fun of Jesus. You can do anything you want. And there's not anybody's going to say a word. You do it against the prophet, you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are critical of you will be Christians. They'll say to you, "What are you doing? You can't make fun of Islam. You want to get us killed?"
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And Muslims assume that asymmetry is inherent in the religion. I guess it's because it's blessed are the meek and turn the other cheek, the golden rule, the Sermon on the Mount ideology in Christianity.
Yeah. Well, Christianity has a long, long literature on whether you can go to war or not go to war. I mean, the whole idea of fighting a battle, having an army, is long debated in the records of the Christians.
Well, there were people that were seeking. Remember, there were people on the walls of Constantinople on its last night, the night before that sought penance for killing people.
Yeah.
And that's a different incentive when the people below the walls are being promised 72 virgins for each one.
And we just
they kill.
Yeah, and we just recently had the Pope, I think we talked about this, tell the Western powers that they're responsible for destroying their nuclear weapons, I think, or they're getting rid of weapons, and so that they won't be fighting wars. It was weird.
That's always been, I mean, that was one of Gibbon's themes, that Christianity had too much territory that was not productive, or their priestly class were not productive. But he also thought that classical martial virtue was eroded by turn the other cheek Christianity, and the enemies of the empire, once it became converted, were under no assumption that they had anything to do with the idea of Christian temperance when it came to war.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then just some historical questions about tomorrow, when this is published, it will be for tomorrow, that the resurrection, I have a couple of questions. One is, why did they need to have a resurrection if the idea behind Jesus was that he came to as part of our forgiveness for our sins, that through him we could be forgiven? Couldn't he have just died? I mean, be crucified, suffered and crucified, and then that was the enactment. Why the resurrection? And then the second question is, what do historians, from a historian's view, what do we know about the last days of Jesus?
In Christianity, there's a duality. Maybe it's partly driven by Neoplatonic thought. But there's a body and a soul, and the soul doesn't die. It goes back to maybe the Socratic simile that your soul is a song and your body is an instrument, and just because your violin or lyre doesn't exist doesn't mean the soul can't exist. It comes to life when it has a body, or it's manifested. And so the idea is that you have everlasting life when your corporal existence disintegrates, and that is emblemized by the murder of Jesus Christ and the burial of Jesus Christ, and then the rebirth or resurrection, the Anastasis, I think it is in the Gospels, the re-standing up or the rebirth of Christ in a divine form that will ascend to heaven, and he will then... He went through this process to allow Gentiles, people who are not Jewish, and the expansion of the Old Testament idea that anyone who accepted the doctrine as found in the Gospels then could be, because of the sacrifice of Christ, it would be emblematic that you would die too. But just as he has been resurrected and gone to heaven, and because he's divine, he is going to do it in corporal form, you too will be rewarded by going to heaven, and then you will be, what's the word? You are going to be marbleized, or you'll be put in suspended animation till the last day. And then during the end of days, then you will be resurrected as well. And supposedly, there's differences about what that final days will be. All of these Jewish sects at the time had different ideas about what happens after death. I think, and I'm not a theologian at any means, but I think the Christian take on it is more like the Pharisees' idea, that some of them think that you'll live just as spiritually or you'll have a divine body. But I think the Pharisees is you die, your body disintegrates, your soul is eternal. And depending on how it was manifested when it was in this body and subject to temptations, that is recorded. And then when you die, your soul then goes up. What was different about Christianity is that he was willing to go through this torture unfairly, and then he dies for your sins. So there's no absolute judge. So in theory, if you're a Christian and you've led a life of sin, on the last day on earth, if you confess your sins and you accept Christ as your personal Savior, and depending on whether you're Catholic or Protestant, there may, if you're Catholic, there's iterations of the process to be saved. So you just don't get a blank check. I don't think limbo is as popular as part of canon now, but purgatory, etc. But the idea is of forgiveness, so that anybody can, if he or she believes in Christ, doesn't fear death, because they're going to their soul will be everlasting, and it will, if you lived a Christian life, be rewarded in heaven. And that is possible because Jesus was willing to be unfairly tortured and killed and sacrificed for our sins. And once he did that, then that allowed all of us to have a chance at redemption and resurrection. So it's also a metaphorical idea that the Son of God came to earth. Earth did not accept him. They killed him. He was sacrificed. He forgave all of them for what they did to him. He reascended to heaven, and therefore he's in all of our lives, and he gives us the same chance that we have a second chance. And we can accept Christianity regardless of our knowledge or ignorance about its Jewish roots or foundations. We don't have to be Jewish in the sense of the Jewish, the Old Testament or the Torah. And where is it in the Bible? It's referred to, as I remember, in all four Gospels. There's, you know, Mary Magdalene, and there's the two angels that see that the tomb is empty on the third day. And I think in one Gospel it says, go to Galilee where he is, and there's the 40 days where he's with. It's not a major part of the Gospels, but the point is there's the scene where the burial tomb is empty. People record they've seen him, four different accounts of this. And then people are directed where you can see him, and the disciples go to him, and then they are told that their duty is to spread the word of Christ. As far as the actual, well, he's dead, and this is why he had to die, and this is what the resurrection means, and this is what happens to you when you die, and this is, your sins are forgiven by the resurrection. That comes from Paul's letters, I remember. Mm. It's not in the four Gospels, the exegesis, the explanation of the whole process and what it means. It's just a narrative account of seeing him alive, and people are shocked.
Mm. Do historians have any evidence from the period of the last days, anything that...
Yeah, it's in Tacitus.
Oh, really? Yeah. Tacitus writes about it.
Yeah, Christ, I think they're called Christus. The Anointed One,
yeah,
and it's he remarks at this period that there's an uprising, and there's and then Christus is one of the people who was, I think, crucified over it. It's in there's four or five classical secular authors where he's mentioned.
Yeah,
so it has. I mean, there's three types of evidence. There's contemporary inscriptions that are not all ecclesiastical. There's also some secular ones by Roman that he was there or there was a problem. And then there, and in the Jewish tradition, contemporary monuments or stone inscriptions. And then there's archaeological evidence of churches and right after his death, monuments, etc. His portraiture. I think that's later, though. It takes a while.
Yeah.
And then there's historians. You know,
and, like Tacitus,
and
yeah.
After his death, they start to be religious, or they're not secular anymore. But Tacitus meant there's another couple more authorities that are not Christian apologists, is what the word is. for what we consider a landmark event in our lives in the West, the birth and especially the death of Christ, you would think in a very well-documented society there'd be more. But as I remember, there's Tacitus, as I mentioned earlier, about the mention of Christus dying. And then there's a lot in Josephus's history of the Jewish people. And then there's a little bit in Lucian as well. And the immediacy of his death is that crucifixion, remember, in the ancient world was considered the most horrific of all punishments. It was the most painful. It lasted for days. So the idea that Jesus was crucified was especially poignant because it showed that he was willing to, and he knew what was going to happen to him. He was willing to go under the most painful, torturous type of death. And but otherwise, you would think that there would be more literature, perhaps, or more secular literature, but there's just really three or four mentions outside of Josephus. And then, of course, there's the four Gospels about the life of Jesus and the death. And they range, you know, from 30, 40, 50 years to 100 and more years after his death, depending on which particular gospel you... And there were other gospels that were not canonized. Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Gospels and things like that. And we have imagery of frescoes of what he looked like.
Yeah.
In the second generation, I think, after his death.
Wow. So do you think that the Hollywood-created versions of Jesus are anywhere near what these images of Jesus were in the media aftermath?
Well, I mean, if you collate Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and you collate Josephus and Tacitus, and you have some knowledge of the geography and the archaeology of Jerusalem and the environs around it, Galilee, if you have all of that, Nazarene, Bethlehem, and you look at imperial inscriptions and things following it, then yeah, I think that you've got a pretty good pictorial, epigraphical, literary, historical accounts of who he was. And what there was a guy named Mortimer Smith. He was a Columbia historian. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm doing this by memory, so I apologize to everybody. But he wrote a book called Jesus the Magician. And he actually came to Cal State Fresno. I had a colleague, Stephen Binko, who was an expert on the Christian writer Epiphanius and the heresies of women and things that Epiphanius wrote about. At the time, I translated it for him. I was a young part-time lecturer, and he was a senior professor in the history department. And he said, you know, I'll support your candidacy at some time, but you got to help me translate this. And it was all in Greek, and one of the heresies had not been translated. But anyway, I got to learn a lot from Stephen Binko about early Christian writers and documents. And there was a lot there. There's a lot to know. So what I'm getting at is by the 50 AD to 100 AD, pretty much there were a lot of people writing about Jesus. But getting back to Mortimer Smith, who Binko invited out, he gave this talk, and I'd read his book, and he wrote a series of books. And his argument was there was during this apocalyptic period in which the Roman Empire had intruded into the Middle East and had taken Jerusalem and was trying to pacify the one province that didn't accept the divinity of the Roman Empire, of the Roman Emperor. There was a lot of cataclysmic events, and there was a band, a throng, a brotherhood of magicians, and they toured around claiming that they had divine powers, and they performed miracles. And he goes through and shows you in contemporary literature that turning water to wine or bringing people back from the dead, these were common claims of magical ability. But it was very unpopular because, of course, he was I don't know what he was, but he must have been an atheist or an agnostic.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. He took away the divinity from Jesus.
And he was, it was a very interesting talk. And I'm sure I'm going to be wrong about the time. That was, I'm going back now.
It was 1978. I looked up the book for you, and it's Morton Smith.
Morton?
Morton, yeah.
Yeah, not Mortimer. Thank you. And was it called Jesus the Magician?
Yeah, Jesus the Magician.
Yeah, and it was very controversial, and I think that he, was he at Columbia?
Oh, that I didn't find, but.
And he came from a whole, a guild. That was the idea.
And, Jesus did.
Yes, yeah. And it was very, it was really something in the late 70s, because he drew on papyri. We have all these magic texts, curse tablets and everything. Yeah. I had a colleague who was an expert in curse tablets and dream books and all this mystical literature, both epigraphic in the sense of contemporary documents.
Yeah.
They, whenever you went to a well, you took a little piece of lead and you, if you wanted to curse somebody, you could do it and you put a pin through it and threw it. And we have those. And it's kind of like witches. And there's also witches in magic stuff in Petronius's Satyricon, but especially in Apuleius and the Golden Ass. But his point was that he was not coming from knowledge of Christian texts. He was coming from knowledge. His background was in secular Greek mystic magic text. So he was saying, he just kind of, what's the word, cobbled together. He said, well, I read the Gospels, and he did this, but he didn't really know any of the it's a whole corpus. It would take a lifetime of the religious literature written between the life of Jesus and, say, 400 A.D.
Yeah.
And he knew nothing about that, as I remember.
Yeah, okay.
And it wasn't his idea either. It was kind of it's an origin in antiquity that yeah. Jesus had magical powers and he might have been one of many,
magicians out there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Victor. This has been a wonderful hour and 15 minutes or a little bit short of that. So we appreciate all your wisdom today, and especially given...
I should say that, I'm not an expert in biblical literature. I've read the Gospels, I said, and a lot of the letters. And I've taught a class in early Christianity, but it's been years. But it's a very complicated field.
Yeah.
Biblical studies, and it requires knowledge of Latin, Hebrew, and Greek. And it's very rare to find people that are so adept in those languages and understand it, and yet come from a disinterested angle.
Yeah.
And are not just trying to promote a particular take on a particular religion.
Yeah. Or against a particular
religion. Or against
religion.
It,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or against it. And academics tend to be more secular than not.
Yeah.
But I have a great admiration for biblical scholars. I've met a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, I have a comment from one of your readers on your website, Victor's Blade of Perseus is the name of the website, and he does VDH Ultra material, and some of those articles are, sometimes he writes The Angry Reader, and so he brings in somebody who has some sort of critique, and he responds to it, and we have a reader from one of the Angry Readers that writes, and this is anonymous. Dr. Hansen, you provide me with a ray of hope each and every time I read your articles or listen to your podcast. The knowledge of history applied to present-day situations make you the most reliable source of potential future outcomes. I cannot thank you enough for sharing your knowledge and insight with us. Thank you, very much. And so that was, I thought that was very nice for this weekend episode. Thanks to all of our listeners. We're happy that you are with us and we invite you back. We have 4 podcasts a week. 2 of them are done by Jack Fowler, who does an excellent job. He and Victor are experts in both in politics, both of them in politics in a way that I am not. And so I'm usually, and also old Western movies. So that's what you can expect on Tuesday, Thursday.
And we're going to have, it's Easter that people are listening to this.
Yeah.
I think Easter is an Anglo-Saxon Germanic word.
Yeah.
From a goddess of the spring.
Yeah.
It's
a pagan thing.
It's a pagan god in Germanic and British Celtic folklore.
Yeah.
About the god of the spring. And I guess that comes from the idea of eggs, too, Easter eggs.
Yeah.
That they renewal.
Is that right?
Yeah. That it's associated with the life of Christ, that the egg is a birth, you know, and that you're renewing life again. And that was a pagan ritual.
Yeah.
And
you would think that the formal church would not accept taking on a pagan ritual. I never quite understood that.
Yeah. There was one time I knew why the date of Easter changes. I know our listeners, but it's something to do between the first Sunday after the new moon, between a late date in March and a late date in April. And that's how it's adjudicated. And it's a big fight. It's the Council of Nicaea. It was a big fight between what would later become Orthodox and Roman Catholicism, the Gregorian versus the Julian calendar.
Yeah. Seems really early this year.
It's a movable feast, a movable date.
Yeah.
And it's a spring pagan festivity to mark the end of winter and the idea that birds and animals are now giving birth because the baby can live in temperate weather and thrive. And it's a renewing. And in Greek mythology, of course, it's Persephone and the kidnap, and that Hades grants that there'll be, she can come part of the year back with her, back to the sunlight in that spring, and then she has to go back into the darkness. But I think Christianity took that pagan myth and used, and in the English-speaking word, because in Greek, I think the word is Pascha, and that comes from a Hebrew word. It's a Greek transliteration of the Passover. But in any case, it's I've always wondered about Easter eggs, but somebody's going to correct me on that as well. I think they're a symbol of death and renewal.
Yeah.
And the chance of a second life and a birth.
Yeah. All right. Well, we wish everybody a wonderful Easter and happy Resurrection Day, too, for you who are Christians. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you, everybody.
This is Sammy Wink and Victor Davis Hanson. We're signing off.